On March 17, 1874, Ira Johnson, medical student, sat in the law offices of Deems, Wingate, Alden, and Deems, and listened to an unusual proposition. At last, he interrupted the senior partner.
"Just a moment. Do I understand that you're trying to hire me to marry one of these women?"
The lawyer looked shocked. "Please, Mr. Johnson, not at all. We are simply informing you that if you were to marry one of the young ladies on this list, it would be our pleasant duty to endow each child of such a union according to the scale here set forth."
Ira Johnson scowled and shuffled his feet. "What's it all about? Why?"
"That is the business of the Howard Foundation. One might put it that we approve of your grandparents.
Have you discussed me with them?"
He felt no affection for his grandparents, a tight-fisted foursome. If any one of them had had the grace to die at a reasonable age, he wouldn't now be worried about money enough to finish medical school.
"We have talked with them, yes, but not about you."
The lawyer shut off further discussion, and young Johnson accepted gracelessly a list of young women. When eventually he did marry, from the list, it seemed a curious but not too remarkable coincidence that his wife, as well as himself, had four living, healthy, active grandparents.
"Mary Sperling, you're a fool not to marry him. You must be nearly 30 and you won't be pretty forever."
Mary smiled wryly. "Don't I know it?"
"Then you should jump at the chance."
"You jump at it. I must run." "Service, Ven. Service."
Ven frowned at the door as it contracted after her friend.
She itched to know why Mary would not marry a prime catch like the Honorable Bourke Vanning. She was almost as curious as to where Mary was off to, and why. But the custom of privacy had stopped her from asking.
Mary had no intention of letting anyone know where she was going. Outside her friend's apartment, she dropped down a bounce tube to the basement, claimed her car from the Robopark, guided it up the ramp, and set the controls for North Shore. The car waited for a break in the traffic, then dived into the high-speed stream and hurried north. Mary settled back for a nap. When its setting was about to run out, the car beeped for instructions. Mary woke up and glanced out. Lake Michigan was a darker band of darkness on her right. She turned into a narrow dirt road which led down to the shore and stopped. There she waited, lights out, and listened. South of her, the lights of Chicago glowed. A few hundred yards inland, the control ways whined. But here there was nothing but the little timid noises of night creatures. She reached into the glove compartment, snapped a switch. The instrument panel glowed, uncovering other dials behind it. She studied these while making adjustments. Satisfied that no radar watched her and that nothing was moving anywhere near, she snapped off the instruments, sealed the windows, and started up again. What appeared to be a standard Camden Speedster rose quietly up into the air, moved out over the lake, dropped into the water, and sank. 17 minutes later, the car surfaced in a pool which occupied much of an artificial cave. Mary got out, said hello to the guards, and went on through a tunnel into a large underground room where 50 or 60 men and women were seated. She chatted until a clock announced midnight. Then she mounted a rostrum and faced them.
"I am 183 years old. Is there anyone here who is older?"
No one spoke. After a decent wait, she went on.
"Then, in accordance with our customs, I declare this meeting opened. Does any family representative have a message? Or does anyone care to speak for himself?"
A man caught her eye and spoke up. "Ira Weatherall, speaking for the Johnson family. This meeting's been called nearly 2 months early. The trustees must have a reason. Let's hear it."
Mary nodded.
"Justin, if you will, please."
A prim little man stood up and bowed stiffly. Skinny legs stuck out below his badly cut kilt. He looked and acted like an elderly, dusty civil servant, but his black hair and the firm, healthy tone of his skin said that he was a man in his prime.
Justin Foote, reporting for the trustees. It has been 11 years since the families decided on the experiment of letting the public know that there were, living among them, persons who possessed a life expectancy far in excess of the average. The first offspring resulting from unions assisted by the Howard Foundation were born in 1875. Back then, the Foundation was an openly chartered corporation, and no unusual methods of concealment were necessary. But then came the series of world wars and the subsequent reign of the prophets, when any minority group was a target for persecution, discriminatory legislation, and mob violence. The so-called masquerade was adopted as a permanent policy. Means were found to simulate the aging and finally the death of any member of the families who lived to a socially embarrassing age, and to provide him with a new identity in another part of the country. Then civil liberty was reestablished in 2075, and the next 50 years saw the renaissance of culture, the steady growth of tolerance and good manners, the increased respect for the custom of privacy and for the dignity of the individual. And so, 11 years ago, we decided on the experiment of letting volunteers numbering 10% of the total membership of the families reveal themselves for what they were and observe the consequences, while maintaining all other secrets of the family's organization. The results were, regrettably, different from our expectations.
Justin Foote stopped talking. The silence had gone on for several moments when a solidly built man of medium height spoke up. His hair was slightly grizzled, unusual in that group, and his face looked space-tanned. Mary Sperling had noticed him and wondered who he was. He said,
"Speak up, bud. What's your report?"
Foote made his answer to the chair.
"Our senior psychometrician should give the balance of the report. My remarks were prefatory."
"For the love of... Bud, do you mean to tell me all you had to say were things we already knew?"
My remarks were a foundation, and my name is Justin Foote, not Bud.
Mary Sperling broke in firmly.
"Brother," she said to the stranger, "will you please name yourself? I'm sorry to say that I don't recognize you."
"Sorry, sister. Lazarus Long, speaking for myself."
Mary shook her head.
"I still don't place you."
"Sorry again. That's a masquerade name I took at the time of the first prophet. It tickled me. My family name is Smith. Woodrow Wilson Smith."
"Woodrow Wilson Smith? How old are you?"
"Eh? Why, I haven't figured it lately. 213 years. Yeah, that's right, 213.
There was a sudden, complete silence.
"Did you hear me inquire for anyone older than myself?"
"Oh, shucks, sister. You were doing all right. I ain't attended a meeting of the families in over a century. Been some changes."
"I'll ask you to carry on from here."
Mary left the platform and found a seat. The man looked around, shrugged, and gave in. Sprawling one hip over a corner of the speaker's table, he announced,
"All right, let's get on with it. Who's next?"
Ralph Schultz, of the Schultz family, looked more like a banker than a psychometrician.
"I was part of the group that proposed ending the masquerade. I anticipated that a few abnormal people would dislike us, even hate us. I predicted that most people would envy us. Everybody who enjoys life would like to live a long time. But I didn't anticipate any serious trouble, since we would be making it clear to them that we owe our... peculiarity to our genes. It's just good luck in our ancestry, nothing more." "No, I was wrong. What actually happened was this. They refused to believe us. What they do believe is that we have some scientific secret, a secret which we will not share. Their envy has turned to hate, and that hate is now swelling into a flood that threatens the welfare and even the lives of all our revealed brethren, and which is potentially as dangerous to the rest of us. That's why we asked for this emergency session, because we can expect trouble at any moment."
No one argued with him. Not only was Ralph Schultz considered expert in his own field, but also every one of them, each from his own viewpoint, had seen the grosser aspects of the trend building up against their revealed kin. But while the acceptance of the problem was unanimous, there were as many opinions what to do about it as there were people present. Lazarus let the discussion muddle along for 2 hours before he held up a hand.
"We aren't getting anywhere, and it looks like we won't get anywhere tonight. Let's take an overall look at it, hitting just the high spots."
He started ticking plans off on his fingers.
"We can do nothing, sit tight, and see what happens. We can junk the masquerade entirely, reveal our full numbers, and demand our rights politically. We can sit tight on the surface and use our organization and money to protect our revealed brethren, maybe haul them back into the masquerade. We can reveal ourselves and ask for a place to colonize where we can live by ourselves. Or we can do something else. I suggest that you sort yourselves out according to those 5 major points of view, and each group hammer out a plan to present to the families. Now, if I hear no objection, I'm going to declare this lodge recessed until midnight tomorrow night."
He stepped down from the platform. Mary Sperling came up to him and looked him in the eyes.
"I would like to know you better."
"Sure, sis. Why not?"
When they reached her apartment, she put tobacco and drink close to him, then went to her retiring room, threw off her street clothes, and put on a soft, loose robe that made her look even smaller and younger than she had looked before. When she rejoined Lazarus, he stood up, struck a cigarette for her, then paused as he handed it to her and gave a gallant and indelicate whistle. She smiled, briefly, took the cigarette, and sat down in a large chair, pulling her feet under her.
"Lazarus, you reassure me."
"Don't you own a mirror?"
"Not that. You yourself. I've passed the reasonable life expectancy of our people. I've been expecting to die, been resigned to it for the past 10 years. Yet there you sit, years and years older than I am. You give me hope."
"You? Expecting to die? Good grief, girl. You look good for another century."
She made a tired gesture.
"Don't try to jolly me. You know that appearance has nothing to do with it. Appearance is just hormones and symbiotics and gland therapy and some psychotherapy and things like that. But Lazarus, I don't want to die."
"We'll outlast the lot of them, Mary. Never you fear. But about the meeting tonight, I haven't paid any attention to the news, and I've only recently come Earthside. Does this chap Ralph Schultz know what he's talking about?"
"I think he must. His grandfather was a brilliant man, and so is his father."
"I take it you know Ralph?"
"Slightly. He's one of my grandchildren."
"That's amusing. He looks older than you do."
"It suited him to arrest his appearance at about 40, that's all. His father was my 27th child. What plan do you think they'll settle on?"
"That bunch tonight? None, of course. They won't get anywhere. A committee is the only known form of life with 100 bellies and no brain. But presently somebody with a mind of his own will bulldoze them into accepting his plan. I don't know what it will be."
"Well, what course of action do you favor?"
"Me? Why, none. Mary, if there's any one thing I've learned in the past couple of centuries, it's this. These things pass. Wars and depressions and prophets and revolutions and covenants, they pass. The trick is to stay alive through them."
He stood up and stretched.
"But right now, this growing boy could use some sleep."
"Me too. Your room's the second door on the right. Shout if you can't find everything you need."
She put her face up and kissed him. A quick peck.
"Night."
When Lazarus went to bed, he stepped out of his kilt and chucked it toward a wardrobe, which snagged it, shook it out, and hung it up neatly.
"Nice catch," he commented,
then glanced down and smiled wryly. The kilt had concealed a blaster strapped to one thigh, a knife to the other. He was aware of the present, gentle custom against personal weapons, but he felt naked without them, and when he came out of the fresher, he put them where he could reach them before sprawling in sleep. He came instantly awake, with a weapon in each hand, then remembered where he was, relaxed, and looked around to see what had wakened him. It was a murmur of voices through the air duct. He got up, refreshed himself, and went looking for his hostess. As the door to the lounge dilated noiselessly in front of him, the sound of voices became loud and very interesting. The lounge was L-shaped, and he was out of sight. He hung back and listened, shamelessly. Eavesdropping had saved his skin on several occasions. It worried him not at all. He enjoyed it. A man was saying, "Mary, you're completely unreasonable. You know you're fond of me. You admit that marriage to me would be to your advantage. So why won't you?"
"I told you, Bork. Age difference."
"Well, now, I have a surprise for you on that point. It's a state secret, but I know you can be trusted. And it will be public knowledge in a few days anyhow. Mary, I'll never grow old on you."
"What do you mean?"
"Just what I said. Mary, they found the secret of eternal youth. You know these old Johnnies that call themselves the Howard families?"
"I've heard of them, of course. But what of it?"
"They're fakes."
"Not at all. I know. The administration's been quietly investigating their claims. Some of them are unquestionably more than 100 years old.
We don't have their secret yet, but we'll have it shortly. They're all to be picked up and questioned. What do you think of that?"
"It would be nice if everyone could live a long time."
"Well, yes, I suppose it would, but in any case, you and I will receive the treatment, whatever it is."
"Wait a moment, Bork. This secret, it wouldn't be for everybody?"
"Well, now, that's a matter of high policy. Population pressure's a pretty unwieldy problem even now. In practice, it might be necessary to restrict it to essential personnel. And their wives."
"You mean I'll have it if I marry you?"
"Well, that's a nasty way to put it, Mary."
"In any case, just how do you propose to get this secret out of them?"
Lazarus could almost hear his wise nod. "Oh, they'll talk. We'll use means, ways that the prophets used, if they don't cooperate willingly."
"Do you mean that? That's against the covenant."
"Covenant be damned. This is a matter of life and death. Do you think we'd let a scrap of paper stand in our way? Look, I'm sorry I ever brought it up. Why not just marry me and not bother your head about matters of public policy?"
"Marry you? Never."
"Give me just one good reason why not."
"I'll tell you why. Because I'm one of those people you want to persecute."
There was another pause. "Mary, you're not well."
"Not well? Listen to me, you fool. I have grandsons twice your age. I was here when the first prophet took over the country. I was here when Harriman launched the first moon rocket. You weren't even a squalling brat. Your grandparents hadn't even met when I was a woman, grown and married. And you stand there and glibly propose to torture me and my kind? Marry you? I'd rather marry one of my own grandchildren."
"Take it easy, Mary. Sit down.
Take your hands off me."
Lazarus stepped into the room and pointed at Vanning with his blaster. "This monkey giving you trouble, sis?" Vanning jerked his head around. "Who are you? What are you doing here?" Lazarus still addressed Mary. "Say the word, sis, and I'll cut him into pieces small enough to hide."
"No, Lazarus, thanks just the same. Put your gun away."
"Okay." Lazarus holstered his gun, but let his hand rest on the grip. "Who are you?" repeated Vanning. "What's the meaning of this intrusion?" "I'm another one of those old Johnnies you're looking for, like Mary here."
Vanning looked at him keenly. "I wonder," he said.
He looked back at Mary. "It can't be. It's preposterous. Still, it won't hurt to investigate your story." He moved toward the video phone. "Better get away from that phone, bud. Don't worry, sis, I won't touch my gun. I'll use my knife." Vanning turned. "I'm leaving. If you're wise, Mary, you'll come with me." She shook her head. He looked annoyed, shrugged, and faced Lazarus Long. "As for you, sir, your primitive manners have led you into serious trouble. You'll be arrested shortly." It was scant minutes after Vanning had gone, but when they stepped out into the public hall, they met a man whose brassard and hypo kit marked him as a proctor.
"Service," he said. "I'm looking for a citizen in company with Citizen Mary Sperling. Could you direct me?"
"Sure," Lazarus agreed. "She lives right down there."
He pointed at the far end of the corridor. As the peace officer looked in that direction, Lazarus tapped him carefully on the back of the head, a little to the left, with the butt of his blaster, and caught him as he slumped. They dropped to the parking level. Once the car was on beamed control and headed north for the family's seat, Mary asked to be excused and caught a few minutes' sleep. Lazarus watched a few miles of scenery, then nodded himself. They were awakened by the jangle of the emergency alarm and by the speedster slowing to a stop. Mary reached up and shut off the alarm.
"All cars resume local control," intoned a voice. "Proceed at speed 20 to the nearest traffic control tower for inspection. All cars resume local control. Proceed at..."
She switched that off, too.
"Well, that's us," Lazarus said cheerfully. "Got any ideas?"
Mary peered out and studied their surroundings. The steel fence separating the high-speed control way they were on from the uncontrolled local traffic strip lay about 50 yards to their right. She started the car again, operating it manually, and wove through traffic. As they got close to the fence, Lazarus felt himself shoved into the cushions. The car surged and lifted, clearing the barrier by inches. Mary set it down, rolling on the far side. A car was approaching from the north, and they were slashing across its lane. The other car was moving no more than 90, but its driver was taken by surprise. Mary was forced to duck left, then right, then left again. The car slewed and reared up on its hind wheel, writhing against the steel grip of its gyros. Mary fought it back into control to the accompaniment of a teeth-shivering grind of Herculean against glass. Lazarus let his jaw muscles relax and breathed out gustily,
"Whew! I hope we don't have to do that again."
Mary glanced at him, grinning.
"Women drivers make you nervous?"
"I just wish you'd warn me when something like that's about to happen."
"I didn't know myself."
Mary drove with one hand while she fumbled in the glove compartment.
"Answer," a voice said.
"Life is short."
"But the years are long."
"Not while the evil days come not."
The voice relaxed.
"Okay, Mary, I've checked you. How's things?"
"I'm in trouble. Get a fix on me."
"Done."
She explained hurriedly the details of what she wanted, stopping once to ask Lazarus if he could swim.
"That's all," she said at last. "But move. We're short on minutes."
While she had been talking, Mary had turned off from the local traffic strip into the unpaved road she had followed the night before, without slowing and apparently without looking. Lazarus gritted his teeth and hung on. They passed a weathered sign reading, "Contaminated Area. Proceed at your own risk." Lazarus blinked at it and shrugged. He couldn't see how, at the moment, his hazard could be increased by a neutron or so. Mary slammed the car to a stop in a clump of stunted trees near the abandoned road. The lake lay at their feet, just beyond a low bluff. She unfastened her safety belt, struck a cigarette, and relaxed.
"Now we wait. It'll take at least half an hour for them to reach us. Do you think we were seen turning off into here?"
"Tell you the truth, Mary, I was too busy to look."
The communicator spoke.
"Okay, Mary, the sub's right in front of you."
"Already?"
"Pete Hardy was available in the Evanston pen," said the voice. "So we homed him in on you. Quicker."
"Okay, thanks."
She was turning to speak to Lazarus when he touched her arm.
"Look behind us."
Less than 100 yards from them, a Proctor helicopter was touching down. Mary jerked open the door of the car and threw off her gown in one unbroken motion. She turned to Lazarus and called, "Come on!" as she tore a stud loose from the instrument panel. She ran. Lazarus unzipped the belt of his kilt and ran out of it as he followed her to the bluff. The blast shook them as the car exploded, but the bluff saved them. They hit the water together. There was a good chance that the Proctors had been killed in the explosion, but they couldn't be sure. So Mary decided not to call the seat from the sub. It would just increase the hazard of detection. She calmed herself and waited, huddled small in a passenger seat too cramped for two.
By the time they surfaced in the pool inside the seat, she had decided against any physical means of communication. Instead, she hoped to find a telepathic sensitive ready and available. Sensitives were as scarce among healthy members of the Howard families as they were in the rest of the population, but the very inbreeding which had conserved and reinforced their abnormal longevity had also conserved and reinforced bad genes as well as good. They had an unusually high percentage of physical and mental defectives, and almost 5% of them were telepathically sensitive. Mary went straight to the sanctuary in the seat, with Lazarus Long at her heels. She braced the matron. "Where's little Stephen? I've got to get a message out to all the families." The matron planted her hands on her hips. "You can't come in here disturbing my children at all hours. I won't have it." "Janice, please, take me to Stephen." "It wouldn't do you any good if I did. He's had one of his bad spells today." "Then take me to the strongest sensitive who's well enough to work. Quickly, Janice. The safety of every member may depend on it." The matron looked doubtful. While Lazarus was trying to recall how long it had been since he had socked a lady, she gave in. "All right, you can see Billy. Mind you don't tire him out." Still bristling, she led them along a corridor, past a series of cheerful rooms, and into one of them. Lazarus glanced at the figure on the bed and looked away. The figure stirred. Its eyes rolled loosely, then seemed to track. It grinned.
"Aunt Nanny, did you bring Billy Boy something?"
"Not this time, hon. Aunt Mary was in too much of a hurry. Next time? A surprise? Will that do?"
"All right."
"That's a good boy." She reached out and tousled his hair. Lazarus looked away again. "Now, Billy Boy, can you hear your friends?"
"Oh, sure."
"All of them?"
"Uh-huh. Mostly they don't say anything."
"Call to them."
There was a very short silence.
"They heard me."
"Fine. Now listen carefully, Billy Boy. All the families, urgent warning. Elder Mary Sperling speaking. The administrator is about to arrest every revealed member. The council are determined to use any means at all to try to squeeze out of us the so-called secret of our long lives. They even intend to use the tortures developed by the prophets. Get busy. Find them. Warn them. Hide them. You may have only minutes left to save them."